is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick in Washington. Immigration. Who comes to this country? It's a huge topic in politics and in the media. But when we talk about it, we often focus on one sliver of the issue, illegal immigration. But millions of people are contending every day with the U.S. legal immigration system. Now, many have been living and working in America for years, stuck in residency limbo as they contend with an alphabet soup of visas and green cards and a system congested with red tape and long waits in line. An immigrant from India who applies for a green card today, that's what grants you permanent residency, can expect to wait in line for 50 years. It's a challenge that 1A listener Puneet Chaudhary knows very well. She wrote to 1A on Facebook to ask us to tackle this issue, and she joins me today from WGVU in Grand Rapids, Michigan. It's the latest in our series of shows suggested by you, our listeners. Puneet, welcome to 1A.
Thank you.
It's wonderful to have you. And thank you for suggesting this topic to us. What have you and your family experienced that made you ask us to talk about legal immigration?
So I'll start by telling you, I came to United States in 2001 to get my doctorate in chemistry. I graduated from University of Texas in Dallas, and I graduated in 2006. I've been here since then. We applied for a green card permanent residency in 2013. My husband's a physician, so we applied through him. I've done different postdocs in this time period, and we thought we were... we wanted to stay here. I want to raise my family here. So we applied for residency, and we're still waiting to be, we're waiting in the queue. We still don't know where we are.
Still don't know where you are. You applied you graduated in 2006. Here we are in 2020. That's, do the quick math, that's 14 years.
Yes.
And you applied, when did you say you applied for permanent, for green card status?
2013.
Okay, so 7 years ago. Can you give me a sense of the process involved here, all of these different steps? What has it been like, whether you want to describe it in terms of paperwork or wait times or both? Give me sort of your eyes into the so-called legal immigration system in the United States and what it means to try to come here.
It's a lot of paperwork, and it's a big burden of proof to show that we are required, like we are important to the community. We provide a service to the community. And so we've met all those burdens. On my end, I have publications. I have a good record of peer-reviewed publications that I've published on my end. But we do a lot of paperwork, if you want to say that, for applying for this.
Well, you came in 2001 as a student. Puneet, what made you decide you wanted to stay after being a student in the United States?
I loved the opportunity that I was offered. So I have a degree in chemistry from India, and I moved, kind of slightly changed my field. So I loved the fact that I wasn't restricted to one field or one choice of area of study. I have now experience in multiple different areas that I was able to gather. And the life that I have here, I was able to get my own car. I got my own house. I was so much more independent than I'd ever been before in my life, make decisions for myself. And that's what I want for my kids, to be able to live in a life where they have choices, they have opportunity, and to know when they do hard work, they'll actually be able to make something for themselves.
Hmm. Now, you talk about the uncertainty of temporary status, being able to work while you wait for the green card status of your spouse and all of the different vagaries there. But I understand this kind of really hit home for you in 2014, right? You took a trip north of the border to Canada, but your trip back didn't go so smoothly. What happened?
So we took a spring break. We thought we'd applied for a green card in 2013. So I thought we were okay, and it should all be fine. So we went to Toronto to take a spring break. And when we actually went for our visa stamping, my husband, who's on H-1, and I'm an H-4, so I'm a dependent. At that time, I was not working. So I didn't think I had any reason to worry. They actually approved his application, and they put me in administrative processing, so I could not come back home with my family.
Well, how long did that take to get resolved?
So it took from the date, it was close to 5 weeks. It took for them to resolve this, and I had to stay, I stayed by myself in Canada in that time.
In a motel? Yes. What did you do?
I cried a whole lot. I checked the internet because basically I had no place to look at or surf because they, there's no website or a place where they tell you this is or a time frame that they tell you it's going to get done in. So you just basically check and check every day and wait for the answer to come back on if you've been approved or what other process needs to be done.
How did that make you feel when that happened?
I did not want to think of what was happening. I prayed every single day that it would be over. The hardest part for me was my girls at that time were little. I had a first grader and a kid who was going to kindergarten, pre-K. And making both of them leave, I think that was the hardest thing I've done so far.
Well, let's talk about work because you came here for an education. You started working after that. I want to ask you about what it's like to find work, to try to work when you're in limbo. We got this call, though, from Jillian in Philadelphia. Listen.
My husband is an Indian immigrant who came to this country more than 22 years ago, finally securing his green card more than 12 years after he arrived as a result of our marriage. My husband came as a student and after completing his graduate studies, secured an employment visa. But that said, he often had to bypass promotions and turn down job offers that provided more seniority and higher salary because it would mean going to the back of the line in the immigration process and securing new sponsorship, which is sometimes expensive, from his new employer. As a result, he sometimes felt trapped in his job because of his immigration status.
Praneet, does Jillian's story sound familiar to you and your job search?
Absolutely. I was nodding my head as I heard that call because, to tell you the truth, I graduated in 2006. I could have gone to work. I had a difficult pregnancy, and I could not go to work right away. I found my first postdoc in St. Louis, where my husband was doing his residency, and every single time I go, I have to... I was fortunate enough to find employers who would sponsor a visa for me initially. But then after my trip to Toronto, I was so scared to apply for one because sometimes you have to go out of the country and come back. And I did not want to take the chance where I would be separated from my kids again. So I did not work for a long time. I did not work for close to 5-6 years because I was so scared to even apply for a position. And now I started working last year. I found I'm working on a project for gene therapy for Parkinson's. And I did not mention this, but my visa's up for renewal and we're not sure if it's going to get renewed or not.
Even now, you're not sure if it will be renewed?
No, I'm not. There's no guarantees.
Praneet, this country has afforded you some incredible opportunities. You've mentioned them, a life, a car, a house, a way to raise your family. And at the same time, left you in Canada in a motel for 5 weeks trying to get back in. Do you feel now, so many years later, that you're part of America?
I think so. My community, the people I have around here, the friends that I have, they support me. And so on that, I feel, but it's hard because I have no other rights. I cannot choose a lot of things. I cannot do a lot of things that I would like to do or be capable of doing. Like Jillian mentioned, now I have started my career over a third time. I could have been a professor. I could have gotten other jobs. I could have maybe started my own company or discovered something else. But I'm still kind of starting from the bottom because I don't know. So I know I have a place. I think I have a place here, and I want to find my place.
And the rest of us might wonder how we might have benefited if Praneet had been able to pursue one of those other jobs that she started out on before all of her complications. But these issues are complicated. It's not just about the point of view of one person. An Indian national who applies for a green card today can expect to wait in line for 50 years. We're going to talk about why and continue with 1A listener Praneet Chaudhary. I'm Todd Zwillick. We have other journalists and experts here as well. You're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Uber. Uber is committed to safety and to continuously raising the bar to help make safer journeys for everyone. For starters, all drivers are background checked before their first ride and screened on an ongoing basis. And now, Uber has introduced a brand new safety feature called Ride Check, which can detect if a trip goes unusually off course and check in to provide support. To learn more about Uber's commitment to safety, visit uber.com/safety.
Mornings don't always go the way we want them to, but now the news starts when you want it to. Morning Edition from NPR News is now available on demand, weekdays from 7 to 3. Just say, Alexa, play Morning Edition.
This is 1A. I'm Todd Zwillick. This hour is the latest in our series of shows suggested by you, our listeners. And with us today is a 1A listener, Puneet Chaudhary, who suggested we talk about the complex legal immigration processes that have left her and millions of other people waiting in line for years for a green card. We've heard from many, many more of you who are on that waiting list. This message came to us from Ann Arbor, Michigan.
I have been in line for immigration since 2010. And it seems like this process keeps taking forever. I have contributed to this economy since I moved here. I've had jobs. I've worked for large Fortune 500 corporations and small businesses. And it pains me that a place that I want to contribute and live in that makes it so much harder for me to become a contributing member.
We got this tweet from Paula, who said, I think we can all agree, if we're honest, that if our ancestors had faced our present immigration system, we wouldn't be here. I want to bring some other voices into this conversation now. Eleanor Pelta, she is a partner with the law firm Morgan Lewis, specializing in immigration law. Eleanor, thank you for being here.
I'm happy to be here. Thank you.
Also at the table is Abigail Hauslohner. She's an immigration reporter for The Washington Post. By the way, we invited the U.S. Citizen and Immigration Services to participate in today's conversation. They did not make anyone available to us. Eleanor, there are a lot of ways that immigrants enter the country legally, though navigating those is definitely not easy. I think we've already gotten a taste of that. Can you, in broad terms, describe what the ways are? You say they go in two major buckets, right?
That's how I think of it. So in one bucket, we have our temporary immigration system. It's like an alphabet soup of temporary visas, and that's how people come here temporarily and do the kind of work that Puneet and others were talking about when they first come here. And then there's another bucket or broad category of permanent immigration or green card immigration. And that's really divided into three broad subgroups: family-based, employment-based, so you're sponsored by an employer like Puneet's husband, and what I would broadly call humanitarian immigration, and that would include refugees and asylees and some other humanitarian classifications.
Many of those categories that have been in the news and controversial,
right,
at the border. Well, Abigail, I want to drill down on this one aspect of legal immigration, the green card backlog. What exactly is that? How do people wind up in the backlog?
There are about 1 million green cards handed out a year by the U.S. government, as in permanent residency. That's the last step before you become a U.S. citizen. And 140,000 of those are employment-based green cards. And they are overwhelmingly Indian. In fact, overwhelmingly Indian tech workers. And that is just a reflection of the population of people who are coming over on the certain type of employment visa, the H-1B, that tends to end up getting sponsored by employers for permanent residency and citizenship. And so not only are, you know, that overwhelming majority, you know, would, you know, you'd think that would translate into an overwhelming majority of Indians getting green cards. And in fact, it is a majority of green cards, or a majority of the employment green cards do go to Indians. However, there is a cap. There's a country per country cap. You can't give one country more than 7% of the employment-based green cards in a year. And so what happens is we've had people, Indians, who are waiting and waiting And there is now a backlog that is an estimated 800,000 people, most of whom are Indian.
And we're going to talk more about that 7% cap. It's highly controversial. Our responses and our Twitter mentions this morning in planning the show prove that it's controversial. We're going to get to that a little bit later in the hour. Eleanor, you work with companies that want to hire immigrants under the H-1B sponsorship program,
correct,
and there are other ways as well. What does it look like from the employer side? There's a qualified person from India. We really want them. What do they have to show in either to get this person to the United States versus hiring somebody who grew up around the corner?
Well, to bring somebody in on an H-1B, they basically have to show that the person's going to work in what's called a specialty occupation. And that's an occupation that requires a baccalaureate degree in a specific discipline. So if you're going to be, you know, a data scientist, you have to have the right background or degree or spectrum of degrees to qualify for that job. But you also have to win the H-1B lottery.
Lottery.
So, yes. There are only a total of 85,000 H-1Bs available each fiscal year. It's capped just like the 140,000 cap that Abby was talking about. When there are more applications for those slots than there are available slots, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services conducts a lottery, and they choose 85,000 cases and they adjudicate them.
Puneet, tell me a little bit about your experience navigating the legal immigration system in this way. I mean, look, you have a rich, complex life like all of us. This isn't the only part of your life. You drive a car, you go to the grocery store, you worry about your kids, you scold them when they make a mess, all that stuff. How big a part of your life is all of this, worrying about paperwork and costs and writing checks and calling people like Eleanor, the lawyers?
It's a huge part of what I have to look at and worry about. Like I mentioned, I'm up for renewal for my visa status of H-4 EAD right now, and I haven't heard back. It's been over 5 months, so I don't know. We have to worry and plan accordingly, because it may just happen that I don't get a renewal, then I have to change my life completely again because of that. Then I also, every time, just to get my driver's license renewed, there's a huge amount of paperwork that goes in to prove that I have the required requisite materials and everything. So it's just like simple things, everything. I have to, when I go in for my employment, I have to give my paperwork and show that I'm authorized to work and get things done. It's not everywhere I go, I use that.
Daigo emailed us, I'm originally from Japan and recently became a permanent resident through marriage with a U.S. citizen. There were clerical errors and snafus with my application. The only fixed cost eventually $800. I received the green card 16 months after the initial submission, and it cost over $3,500. Eleanor, does that case sound typical? It sounds pretty smooth in his case.
People who are married to U.S. citizens are actually not subject to any quota. So almost a
completely different universe than what we're talking about. Marriage is the key in that case.
Right, except that they are subject to bureaucratic delays, which have increased over the last few years.
All right, we got this message in our inbox from Florida.
I'm Sanjana and I'm from Orlando. And my family and I have been in this green card process for about 10 years now. And there's this thing where if your dependent child is 21, they can no longer be with you in the green card process. So I had to get out of my dad's green card process and start from the bottom and get an international student visa. And this really affected my family and so many of my neighbors in the similar situation, because we can't get any scholarship and we are limited to which medical schools we can apply to.
Eleanor, that fellow attorney of yours says that the system is a mess to navigate, even for him, a professional. And that's before you get to what obviously must be language barriers for many, many people trying to come here or stay here. Can you give me a sense of what this system is like to navigate?
Well, apart from the problems posed by the quotas, which are really, you know, require legislative fixes, over the past few years, the agency has gotten far more difficult to navigate. It is much more difficult to speak to a human being, to resolve a problem, for a foreign national to make an appointment to go in and meet with someone at a local USCIS office. You practically have to have a dire life and death situation. Anything less than that, it's impossible to speak to someone. So if there is a snafu, if there is a problem, if there's a clerical error that's causing a delay, it's very difficult to get that resolved.
Abigail, we're going to talk more about the backlog delays that are part of just the system, but this is something different. This is just inefficiency, poor design, that old bureaucracy we all like to rail against, and maybe with good reason. The immigration system outside of the actual four corners of the rules sounds like, at least from these anecdotal reports, it is not functioning.
No, it certainly is not. A former Bush administration official actually recently described it to me as a patchwork quilt of solutions, in that there really hasn't been any meaningful legislation really kind of overhauling or reformatting the immigration system in decades. What has gotten by over the years occasionally are little pieces of legislation that are very narrow and tackle little things, you know, in terms of changing something on H-1Bs, for example, or authorizing, you know, a certain set of visas for this year. But what, you know, attorneys, and I'm sure Eleanor can speak more to this, what I hear from experts is that, you know, together, that does not represent anything comprehensive. In fact, it may just make things even more complicated because there are ripple effects through the system.
Eleanor, the times when there have been small parochial expansions in work visas or H-1B visas, is that largely because they are pushed by people with access, big corporations who know how to get things done and say, hey, look, we need 1,000 more of these because we need these people in our labs? And
I honestly can't remember the last business immigration fix. And I don't think that the large corporations are having any more success than anyone else. I mean, what's so interesting is that you hear a lot of talk about making our system a merit-based system, but in the employment-based category, it is merit-based. We have subcategories for Nobel Prize winners and other geniuses and people like Puneet, and we have, you know, categories for people with master's degrees. We don't have enough numbers. That's the problem.
IT Doc tweeted this. I'm an Indian physician waiting in the green card backlog for more than 8 years. I've been in the United States for 14 years. The worst part is that after being here for so long, if I get disabled or I die, my family, including my children, have to self-deport. And this is the only country they've ever known. Is reform to this system possible? More from our guests, our experts, and from Puneet, and from you in just a moment. This is 1A.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from the Walton Family Foundation, where opportunity takes root. More information is available at waltonfamilyfoundation.org.
Do you talk about the news with your friends, your family, or perfect strangers? Get the facts you need to be up to speed on this busy news cycle so you can share what you know on the News Roundup. Find the podcast in your feed every Friday. Well, we're talking about what it takes to legally immigrate to and stay in the United States. There are attempts at reform. A Senate Bill 386 would change current law, which limits any country from receiving more than 7% of green cards. Abigail, you mentioned this cap, 7%. And we heard from a lot of people on Twitter about this. This 7% cap and the reform efforts are controversial. Sam tweeted this: S-386 is a racist bill designed to benefit only people from one country. If this bill is passed, it will take more than 12 years for a Harvard graduate to get a green card, while an Indian from unknown university gets a green card. And Maddie tweeted this: there are close to 500,000 people waiting for green cards for decades, while the other country's citizens don't even need to be here to get a green card. This systemic unfairness would be eliminated by S-386. The ones against it are pandering to the alt-right extreme right. Abigail, what is this debate? Why is it so contentious?
Well, part of the contention arises from the fact that in both of those experiences or opinions that you just heard, there is truth. There is some truth to both of those. And so that is, eliminating what S386 does is it eliminates the per country cap. The reason people are so passionate about this is that eliminating the per country cap would mean that the backlog, the folks who are overwhelmingly Indian, would then be able to collect their employment-based green cards on a first-come, first-served basis. Now, there's a sort of a phase-out provision to that bill that protects other nationalities for a couple of years. But for the most part, analyses of this bill have shown that this could mean basically mostly, if not only, Indians collecting employment-based green cards for anywhere from 7 years to the next 17 years.
Because of the sheer numbers already backlogged and coming here.
That's right.
And maybe that's what led to Atira, who tweeted this. There is a backlog for India caused by H-1B visa abuse and big tech fraud, not by the per-country cap. So obvious that removing the per-country cap in S-386 will not solve the backlog. That bill was created will create a new backlog for the talents from the rest of the world who had no role in creating the issue in the first place, and it's unfair.
Right. Well, the repercussions of, you know, of basically allowing only Indians in for, or rather only Indians to get employment-based green cards for the next, you know, 10, 17, whatever years, means that, you know, the backlog continues. In fact, these analyses say the backlog continues to grow. You know, it could be 1 million people in 10 years' time. And not only that, but while the wait extends, say, to 17 years to get a green card, that means everybody. So it goes from, you know, right now, Indians who have been waiting about 10 years are collecting their green cards. It'll mean everybody, all nationalities, are then waiting 17 years.
What does this accusation of H-1B visa abuse and fraud refer to? What's the thing there?
That person's talking about the H-1B visa system, which is, it's the big work visa. Eleanor can get into this more. Primarily the users, now Puneet's husband has an H-1B, she mentioned. He's a physician, but a lot of the people with H-1Bs are tech workers. And again, a lot of these folks are Indians. The abuse that he's talking about is that there have been serious allegations, you know, and reporting on abuses of this H-1B system by U.S. tech companies over the past, you know, decade or more, really since the big tech boom of the 90s and early aughts. And what you've seen is, and what you hear from, say, American workers, is that there's unfair competition because the H-1Bs are being handed out, the allegation goes, too easily. And that because of these wait times, because of the green card, because an Indian tech worker is going to be waiting for a decade or more for a green card, they are then they are here on an H-1B in the meantime, and they are tied to their company. So that means they are limited in the extent that they can get raises. They are limited in the extent that they can change jobs.
They have no leverage in the market.
They have zero leverage. And they also, you know, would expectedly, you know, feel really tied to whatever their employer wants. In that, you know, I've heard from a lot of Indian workers who feel like they can't really challenge their employer for better, you know, working conditions, for example, because they are dependent on that company to apply for their green card and follow
now,
through.
Now, we talk about the need for reform. Zoe Lofgren is a congresswoman who happens to represent California and happens to represent a district pretty tech heavy with a lot of tech companies in her district. Now, she is the author of HR 1044. It's the same as S386, just on the House side. It's the House version. 1A producer Avery Kleiman had a conversation with Zoe Lofgren yesterday to get at this issue of the backlog of the H-1B visas and what she thinks reform should look like.
You represent Silicon Valley, and tech companies lobbied pretty hard for this legislation, and that's because they really stand to benefit. A lot of the people they want to hire and keep in the United States are STEM workers, many of them from India, who have a very long waiting time. Does the whole country benefit from this legislation, or does your district, Silicon Valley, disproportionately benefit?
Let me give you an example out of Silicon Valley, a doctor who I met. This doctor is from India. His wife is also a doctor, also from India. They're the only two doctors in this little town in the Midwest. They have been waiting for 12 years. and they looks like they're going to wait for, they don't even know how long. The children have basically grown up in the United States. They don't know anybody in India. They don't speak a language other than English that's spoken in India. They are about to age out of their dependent visas. These two doctors were going to close their practice and move to Canada. I said, hold on, we're going to try and get a resolution for you. We haven't yet, but ultimately, because they have obligations to their sons and daughters, they'll have to close their practices and move to Canada.
The senators who agreed on a bipartisan version of your bill said they wouldn't put it to a vote because it wouldn't pass. So what happens next for your version?
Well, we had an overwhelmingly positive vote in the House. I wish the Senate would pass it. They've proposed, you know, various tweaks to it, which we are very open to doing. But in the end, the Senate is the Senate. I can't do it for them.
That was 1A producer Avery Kleinman speaking with Congresswoman Zoe Lofgren of Silicon Valley in California. Eleanor Pelta, the congresswoman says, well, this isn't really about big tech. It's not so much about my district. It's really about the people who are a doctor in a rural area. Do you buy that, or is largely the power behind this, to the extent it has any, about big tech?
Well, I do actually agree with what Zoe Lofgren is saying, because that's been my experience as a practitioner as well. I did want to clarify a couple of things. In my view, I think that a connection between H-1B alleged fraud and the backlogs is a bit of a red herring. I think the problem with the backlogs is the ridiculously low number of employment-based visas available every fiscal year. And until that gets resolved, the backlogs aren't going to get resolved. And some of the people who are against 386 and 1044 feel that if we don't add additional numbers, all we're doing is rearranging the deck chairs on the proverbial Titanic. But in my view, and when we say Indian tech workers, I want to kind of clarify that a little bit. First of all, Indians are not the only nationality impacted by backlogs. Chinese nationals are impacted by backlogs. And tech workers, let's just say that's a very broad category. I do a lot of work with pharma companies. I see a lot of Indian nationals in that industry as well. They're statisticians, they're data scientists, they're biotechnologists. They're not just computer systems analysts. So we're really looking at a number of industries that can benefit if this is fixed.
Abigail, I want to make sure that we touch on this issue of children aging out, because IT physician, the doctor who tweeted in before, mentioned that if anything happens to him, that his children would have to leave, or people can age out of this system. What does that look like for dependents of people who are working here under some kind of visa status?
Right. This is where a lot of the passion and emotion comes in, which is that if someone who is in line for an employment-based green card dies, since they are the applicant, their family, so their spouse, their kids, they then lose their spot in line and they are effectively deportable.
And they're not under DACA. The children aren't.
Nope.
No.
No. And that they
because
lose
they
it.
Came
they're
here
out.
Legally. They came here legally. They're not.
They came here legally, but their status, their legal status, is tied to the parent, the spouse who applied. So, for example, in Puneet's position, if God forbid something happened to her husband, you know, that she could lose, she would lose her place in the U.S. despite having waited as long as she had. And you see the same thing now with kids. When kids reach 21, you know, if their parents are in the green card backlog, too bad. 21, they age out. That means they are no longer in line with their parents. They are on their own. They are deportable.
One of the many, many dozens, hundreds of issues in an immigration system that is fundamentally broken, not just illegal immigration that we talk about all the time, and we should, and we will continue having that debate in this country, but the system, the patchwork quilt that we have in place for people who do, as we're fond of saying, play by the rules and come here legally. In many ways, they confront something that is no easier. I want to thank all of our guests for joining us. A show that was suggested by our listener, Puneet Chaudhary, the 1A listener who gave us this show idea and shared your experiences. Puneet, thank you for coming on and being so open and intimate with us. We really appreciate it.
I am so glad that you've covered this, and I hope there's more awareness. People understand that I'm not taking something from anyone. I want to be a contributing member of this community.
Panit Chaudhary.
I want that chance.
Panit Chaudhary in Grand Rapids, Michigan. I also want to thank Eleanor Pelta, partner at Morgan Lewis, specializing in immigration law. Thank you. And Abigail Hausloner, immigration reporter for The Washington Post. Thank you.
Thanks for having us.
This conversation was produced by Avery Kleinman and edited by Matthew Simonson. To learn more about them and the rest of the team, visit the1a.org. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington. It's distributed by NPR. Until we meet again, I'm Todd Zwillick. Thank you so much for listening. This is 1A.